Hey, before we jump into this week's podcast, I just wanted to send out a quick note that I am taking sponsors for the Healthy Competition podcast. So if you want to get your name in front of hundreds of product marketers and competitive intel practitioners, reach out to me at Andy at healthycompetition.co. That's Andy at healthycompetition.co, and we'll talk things through. All right, that's it. On to this week's episode. So just some quick background on this episode. A couple of months back, my LinkedIn feed was flooded with videos of a bunch of sales influencers smashing their keyboards. It was hilarious, and like I said, my feed was filled with these videos. Turns out that a company called WinAI, that's WINN.AI, was behind the campaign and they used it to bring awareness to the launch of their product. I thought it was amazing, and I knew I had to reach out to their co-founder and CEO, Eldad, to learn more. So this episode is going to be great for you if you're curious how to stand out and differentiate as a startup, and if you want to get some behind the scenes of a really good guerrilla marketing campaign. All right, let's jump in.
Cool. So I have a strange story. So I'm not the typical sales guy, even though it's a sales tech company, and I'm the co-founder and I'm the CEO. So I came to the world of sales just 5 years ago. Before that, very different background, 7 years in the Israeli Navy. I'm a former naval officer, so served for 7 years, and then 7 years in the world of NGOs in Israel once again. So founded a couple of NGOs here. One of them is with my wife, which is a leadership program for girls. And 5 years ago, I joined the Israeli startup in the world of diabetes, became the first salesperson. And they fell in love with sales. And this is how the story starts.
Did you always picture yourself as at least a founder? Forget about selling or being a salesperson, but like when you were leaving the Israeli Defense Force, did you always know that you were going to found a company?
That's a good question. So going back to the age of 20, 25, 24, I knew that I want to be a leader. And it started to be a leader in more in the political arena. And I didn't tell that, but I was like the chairman of the Hebrew University Student Union. So I had my experience also in this arena. And then I was a leader in the world of social entrepreneurship. And then around the age of 30, I decided to do a shift in my life and to go to do business. But the virus of leadership and, you know, doing something meaningful and creating something from scratch was always there. It's just changed the form. So it moves from political to social to business.
And then how did specifically being in the Israeli Defense Force, how did that impact you as a leader?
I used to call it the best school on earth, because at the age of 18, you get tons of responsibilities. Second, you are surrounded by super smart people who are by definition smarter than you. And I remember, for example, one of my team members, he was, you know, so smart. He was the worst combination: smart, hardworking, and humble. You know, you want to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, like get out of here with that.
Yeah, what's going on, Mr. Perfect? You need to digest the situation that this is the people who surround you. And you won't be number one. No matter how hard you're going to work, you won't be the smartest person on deck. And you need to find your own superpowers. And I think that it was a transformative experience to be in the Navy, because I became like super, super competitive in a very good way. I became very ambitious. I became very aware of my leadership skills, getting responsibility at the age of 19, 18. And, you know, people can be killed because of you. You're responsible for life of people. That's growing up on steroids. And that was beautiful school for leadership. Tons of mistakes. And I'm keep doing mistakes, but hopefully I'm not doing the same mistakes I did when I was 18.
How do you think that specifically like translates in, you know, the piece that you mentioned specifically about being around a bunch of people who are just smarter than you in every sense of the word? How do you think that translates into being a founder? Because I've also heard of a ton of different founders, number one, getting burnt out because they feel like they're doing a bunch of stuff. They can't do it all. And then they eventually have to close down shop. But the ones that really end up succeeding end up leading people who are smarter than them and are able to take ownership of individual pieces of a business in ways that the founder is unable to. How have you been able to
approach that in the business world?
Oh, it's really interesting what you're asking, because till this moment, now I'm having an enlightenment. I can show you, I can put light here. I didn't connect between the fact that I was surrounded by smarter people to my current approach to leadership. And I will try to explain what I'm saying. By definition, I'm surrounding myself with smarter people in the company today. So for example, say Bar, my CTO, and I, for one of the first hires was a product person. Because both of us said, we don't know, let's bring someone who knows. And we brought someone who really knows. And then we said, maybe we should do PLG. So let's bring someone who knows PLG. So we brought like someone who's, you know, one of the leaders in PLG in Israel. So we surrounded ourselves with super smart people who knows by definition better than us. And I think that the other part of this equation is to create an environment which gives everyone the same voice. Because it's one thing that you say, okay, I want to bring like super smart people, but then you don't give them the space and you are the CEO, you know, whatever it means, and it kills that. And it gives their spirit and their ownership and accountability and everything. So it's a combination. It's an ongoing process, I think.
I always like to learn about people's backgrounds and like their leadership styles before we dive into like the specific product itself. You know, with all of that context, I'd love to know, how did you, number one, stumble upon Win as just a product, as like the opportunity for Win? We'll go ahead and start there, and then we'll kind of dive into some of the other stuff that has kind of caught my attention.
So 5 years ago, joined the startup in the world of diabetes, became a salesperson by mistake, by the way. That's also an interesting story, but we can speak about that afterwards. Discovered that I really love sales. I like love the energy, the pace, the combination between EQ and IQ, the numbers. I love everything about it. Part of one thing which I hated from day one, which is updating the CRM. That's shit, like sorry for the word. And it's tedious and it's boring and horrible. And then 1 year later, I became a head of sales of the company, and I had several AEs and SDRs, and I discovered how difficult it is to create the alignment and consistency between them. And then whether it's about like, how do they do discovery? How do they qualify leads? How do they speak about the product? Everything. So I went and wrote a playbook, and the day after I wrote the playbook, nobody used the playbook, and a true story. I'm meeting them tomorrow, actually, like my old team tomorrow for a beer. So it's a good
follow up there. Yeah.
Yeah, I will tell them that I owe them. Anyway, so those experience, rather as an individual contributor, but also as a leader, made me think, okay, that's something interesting there. And then around January 2021, I left the company after 2.5 years and decided by definition that I'm going to build a startup. And then I started the whole process of ideation and validation, spoke with more than 200 VP sales, and we understood that those are very, very common problems, even in the world of Gong and Chorus and Salesforce and Salesloft and Outreach, and tons of everybody hates to update the CRM still. So that was a very common problem, unsolved problem on the one hand. And on the other hand, people go to consulting and sales consulting leaders that take sales consulting and methodologies and MedPeak and everything. And if you ask them, do people follow the best practice? Do people follow the playbook? Do people follow the sales methodology that you want them to use because you believe it should lead them to success? Probably the answer will be no, 100%. I'm 99%. And this came brought us to the understanding that the way to solve it is with a real-time assistant for salespeople. So it's a combination of better adoption of the sales methodology for the sales leaders and less admin work for the sales person. And that's basically what we do today.
So is the way that the product works is sellers on a demo, Win is in the background listening in and then capturing specific insights that a seller would then need to update their CRM with after a call typically, but Win is doing that separately.
So let's elaborate about this for a little bit more. I think it's just to look at the aspect of the CRM updates, it's like a little bit narrowing the developer position. So the first thing is to put the right agenda on the right side of the screen. So it could be discovery, demo, negotiation, closing, whatever it is, you have it on the right side of the screen as a very good reminder of what should I do now. in real time, what we know to do is to tell the salesperson, hey, you covered that, you covered that, you covered that, you covered that, you covered that. You haven't covered this and that and that. Third, what we know to do is also to capture the notes in a very granulate way. So it's not like a summary, which is today's commodity. It's not something special. But to be able to capture what is interesting for this specific salesperson in his specific playbook, and then when the call is done to transform, to push everything to the CRM, that's quite unique. So those are the main value proposition in real time. And now we are building, you know, a whole things on top of that, like follow-up emails and tasks in Salesforce more and more and more.
What category would you consider Wynn playing in? Because, you know, I've read some mentions of it being a CRM on your website, but then, you know, based on the description of the product also on the website, there's some elements of conversation intelligence like Gong or Chorus. So like, how do you think about Wynn?
Yeah, for sure, we are doing things in the world of conversational intelligence, but I love to speak about real-time assistant. You know, and I think that real-time assistant it's a good definition. Real-time assistant for salespeople. Happily, I can say that we have direct competitors today, and I'm saying happening because I used to work in a company that had no direct competitors, and by the way, that's a very bad sign. I was very proud about that in the beginning.
Well, that's the other thing too. I mean, I think it's really good to
have healthy competition.
Yeah, that's the whole point, right? To kind of talk about some of this stuff. So like when you were going about building Wynn and you saw some of the other players that might have been kind of solving this solution, you know, how did you evaluate how effective they were being? Like, how did that kind of spark seeing the competition, but knowing that you were still going to move forward and put together a different or a better kind of solution with Wynn?
Yeah, so I think that once again, it's very hard to have one answer for that. So let's try to split it into two or three. So let's take the one of the Dooley and the Scratchpad that exist like 4 years, I think 5 years, with the promise of a better UI for Salesforce and every also Rattle, for example. So they have their own UI. Rattle is doing it through Slack. When we saw that, it was, you know, okay, that's on the CRM aspect, that's super interesting. And of course, we learned lots from those companies, but it was missing the whole automation. So once again, it was a better UI, but still you needed to do manual data entry. So we said, okay, that's kind of, you know, where we fit. So that was first. The second part, which was more challenging because it was also a challenge. For example, you know, how many investors in the US knows about Scratchpad and Dooley? Probably there are a bunch, but I would say it's not like 90%. How many investors in Israel knows about Gong? A whole different story.
Yeah, and, right.
Yeah, because that's the backyard here. And even in the US, the investors knows all about Gong. So probably in Israel, like it was 200%, right? So for Gong, it was a different play. And actually, I was very curious about Gong. So what I did first thing is to go to Google. So we went to Google and we wrote Gong real time, and you're gonna be surprised that till today, if you click on Gong real time, you're gonna find a PR from 2017 saying, and it was the second PR by Gong after they raised $6 million, saying we're gonna be real time assistant on an objection handling and blah, 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 like tons of things that we are doing today. And then I was very curious because I know that Gong is not doing anything in real time. And then I started to do a whole journey about, you know, better understanding what was the reason why Gong wanted to do this, tried to do this, didn't try to do this, and there's a whole conspiracy what happened there without getting into too much details. But when I did my small research, I was with very high-level executive in Gong, I came to investors and I told them, listen, Gong are not going to do what we're going to do in the next 2 years.
There's your opening.
Why? Yeah. There's an opportunity here.
Got it. Okay, that makes a ton of sense. You know, talking about that kind of like AI assistant space, that makes a lot of sense given kind of your description of Wynn relative to some of those other players in that space. Well, let's talk about this kind of like influencer campaign that you ran a couple months ago. It was all kind of based off the idea that usually people are using their keyboards to update CRM. And Wynn, like one of the big value props there is that you don't have to use your keyboard at all. You can just use your mouse, which is a big win, no pun intended, for salespeople. Mm-hmm. This reminded me of kind of with engineers, but it's almost the opposite. engineers usually just want to keep their hands on the keyboard. They don't want to use the mouse. I thought this was genius. You're just kind of flipping it and you're targeting it to a different audience. Was that a big kind of pain point that you realized as you were in sales? Or like, I had never heard of that, but I thought that that was fascinating.
Yeah. So once again, I think that the frustration from, so for example, today I met with a RevOps of one of our customers, and part of the team is not working with WinAI, and they take the notes on SalesLoft. So they take the SalesLoft notes and then they copy it. Then they go to Salesforce, they paste it, and then they take it and split it into the fields. And the fields, some of them are pick list, some of them are date, some of them whatever it is. And they hate this process so much. And it's not about the fact that they are typing. So typing is very visual. It's very bureaucratic. It's like dealing with something so small and creates like kind of tension that you want to smash something. It's not about the fact that you are actually like typing a lot. It's the fact that you need to do something which is very small and very accurate. Potentially, once again, it's not accurate. Like with tons of dependencies and mandatory fields. And so the experience is really, you know, it's a bad journey. And a very, once again, very strong visual for frustration is smashing something. What you're going to smash? You're going to smash the keyboard, right? And it went well with the journey that we are offering. So today, actually, people who use WinAI update the CRM with one click.
So let's jump to the campaign then. So a couple of months ago, you did this campaign with a bunch of different sales influencers. And pretty much the videos were all like home videos of them smashing their keyboards that were sent by you. And I can imagine, number one, it filled up my LinkedIn feed for like a solid 2 days. And so mission accomplished, definitely from a brand awareness perspective. But number two, I can't imagine how much time and effort it took to, number one, get all of the influencers to buy in, essentially, to get them to trust this tool that is, you know, up and coming, you know, not widely known. And then to coordinate all of that with all of them to record this thing and post it on the same day. Can you just walk me a little bit through like the background of putting that campaign together, how long it took and any kind of challenges that came along with it?
I will tell you one thing which is super interesting about this campaign. I think that most of it was very ambiguous. So, and we got pushbacks about that. And I will tell you what. So when the influencers said, I'm in, they said, I'm in to something very, very ambiguous. I told them, listen, we have a very creative idea for a campaign. I'm going to send you something and it's going to be unboxing like you do on beauty and things like that. But it's going to be a very strange, interesting, creative activity. And I told them, and it's funny because on the outreach message, I said, I swear to God, it's not swag. That's the traditional thing. You send swag, and then you take a picture with the hoodie, blah, blah, blah. This is what Salesforce did like 3 months ago. And that's very traditional. And I created some kind of curiosity and tell them it's going to be different. I can tell you that. I don't like it. I don't know if you're going to like it or not, but it's going to be different. And I think that brought at least the initial curiosity about it. When people got the package, some of them said that I'm not willing to participate.
Really? Okay. And why is that?
Two main pushbacks about it. One, and which is more, I think that was the main reason, it didn't fit their persona.
Got it. Okay. Maybe they were a little too professional or kind of buttoned up and like the act of smashing a keyboard didn't really fit with them kind of a thing.
Yes. But okay. Once again, you know, that's the decision of people and
fine.
A minor concern was about a recycling and then it's not a good message, smashing a keyboard and things like that. But I think that it was more about the first objection. And, you know, in some point I told them, listen, you don't need to smash it. You just, you know, you can take a picture with it or something like that. But, you know, when you're not feeling comfortable, so I felt, okay, don't do it. Fine. You just have a keyboard with Hebrew letters on it and it's a present for you. So that was a very interesting thing that I didn't anticipate it. I didn't see it coming. But basically, so it was like a military operation, starting with mapping all of the right people that we want them to participate. We approach them as the SDRs do. We jumped on a call. We told them, hey, this is what we're going to do. And on the same time, we had a whole crazy operation about to create the box and branding. And then, you know, you need to think about security. And then you know, send goggles. And we send a whole explanation on how to do it. And we tried it ourselves.
Don't want to get hurt.
You don't want people to get hurt on the one hand. But on the other hand, you want it to be very visual. So, you know, we had some trials and errors there. And in some point, we have more than 100 addresses. And then you need, by the way, you need to get the address. You need to get the phone number. You need to get the so it's a whole.
Yeah. How long did this take? Like, when did you first start reaching out to people?
I think like 2 months before.
Okay. Got it. So a 2 month campaign.
I'm a very intense person. So
I was about to say, so you must have like really pushed to make sure that it got done.
Yes.
And was this something that like the whole company was kind of working on too? Or is it just a small team within?
Yeah, mainly the go-to-market, and it's a very small team.
And some of these people, I'm sure you'd already known from like personal contacts and whatnot too.
Yeah, but I would say not majority of them, because you know, really? when you need to get to 100, so maybe 40 of them I knew before, but the rest of them were, you know, cold outreach and one introduced to the another, and you know.
How about the results of the campaign, right? Because I mean, I can tell you that like for me personally, I had never heard of you before, but now I do. And I think it's really cool. How do you go about tracking the success of something like this?
Yeah, so we got more than 700 signups on the campaign from the campaign and more than 100 demos requests. We have paying customers from this campaign. And actually we started selling with the campaign. So we are up and running, you know, selling the product only 2 months. Now it's 8 months from when we launched the product. So yeah, we see revenue from that and people are willing to pay for that. So it means that it was not only a good campaign, but also a good product, you know?
Yeah. And that's also, so like the thing that sticks out to me as something that people could take away from this is, well, actually, like, did you also do PR or anything else along those lines to say like, hey, yeah, like we're open now?
Yeah, we did a little bit of PR. I wouldn't say that was super strong piece of that. It was more like a guerrilla. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think that just goes to show like how important some of that stuff is into getting people's attention these days. Like you could have just kind of done a press release, done a LinkedIn post, did a little video saying, hey, like we're open, but like the way that you approached it really stood out and you really made a splash with it.
Yeah. I think that what we see now is a new era where the whole media, social media balance is very different from what it used to be.
Okay, one last question and then I'll let you go. So the other piece too that I wanted to touch on was, you know, usually people want to have their customers spending more time in their product, you know, that like just because that shows adoption, that people like love, you know, being in there, that's like a platform, all that kind of stuff. But with Win, you know, I see that you're promoting the idea of sales spending less time in this tool or in their CRM in general. So how are you approaching tracking like adoption and success with Win if it's not by the amount of time being spent in your app?
I think one of the problems that we see now that because it's such a bad process, people don't update the CRM at all. So for example, what we discovered in a very well-known and very established company is that half of the calls are not tracked. And I'm not talking about SDRs. Well, you know, not tracking unqualified leads or whatever it is. I'm talking about AEs that not tracking like half of their calls, nowhere. So, you know, a good KPI could be, you know, moving from 50% to 100%.
Of track calls.
Yes.
Yeah.
And second, it could be, okay, so now we moved from 50 to 100. How are they being tracked? Are they tracked as a bulk? With the bulk, you can do nothing. You can get trends. You can do business intelligence. You can do nothing. So is it as a bulk? Is it on fields? On how many fields? How much time it took them to push things to the field? So it's the combination of that. Plus, and this is the mind-blowing thing, is we were able to improve the adoption of the sales methodology from around 50% in the one of the customers in just 3 weeks from around 50% into 80%. And that was the fact that you have the right the right piece of information on the right side of the screen. It's a good reminder. So people, you know, it changed the way that they operate.
So it's tying not just to like the usage of your tool, but just of the overall initiatives that are important to the company.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Hey, listen, I had a great time chatting with you. This was really cool to kind of get a little behind the scenes of what I consider one of the cooler campaigns that I've seen throughout the year. Where should people follow you if they want to learn more, or where should they go if they want to learn more about Win?
The best thing is it's WinAI. So it's WINN.AI. That's our website. That's our brand. That's everything. So win.ai, that's beautiful to follow. Personally, I'm very active on LinkedIn. Some people will say that I'm too active, but that could be a great place.
All right. Like I said, thanks for hanging out. This is awesome to chat with you.
Thank you, Andy. It was a pleasure.
Hey, you made it to the end of the episode. I have one small favor for you now. If you could please rate this podcast 5 stars wherever you're listening to it, that'd be super helpful for me. For Spotify, you can only leave a review on the mobile app. And you can do that on the top of the Healthy Competition podcast profile. And for Apple Podcasts, you have to scroll to the bottom of the show's page and click Write a Review. Each podcast episode takes about 5 hours of my time from beginning to end, while reviewing it should only take about 5 seconds of your time. Plus, you'd be making my day. So thank you so much in advance, and see you in the next episode.